Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies at UC Berkeley. We are today commemorating the 25th anniversary of the founding of the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. And we're being joined by two distinguished professors who have distinguished themselves in their scholarship and in their government service. Joining us are Herb York, who is the founding director of the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, and Susan Shirk, who is the current director. Welcome to Conversations. Herb, let's go back 25 years. What was President Saxon's mandate to you when you established the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation?
Well, to contribute to the university's study and involvement in the Cold War, really. The university had been operating the two nuclear laboratories for many years at that time, and David Saxon and also Governor Jerry Brown wanted to essentially broaden the university's participation into something beyond just making weapons. They wanted to get the university involved in finding solutions to the Cold War, helping to find ways out. So that's basically the mandate was to set up an institute that would do that, study the Cold War and the problems the Cold War created, the nuclear threat in particular, but in terms of social sciences, history, politics, international relations, and any other way that academia could contribute to studying the problem.
And what was the source of the funding?
Well, the source of the funding in the beginning was primarily it came from the fees for running the laboratories, and it came actually in, even at the beginning, it came in two parts: one directly from the regents, and one associated directly with the fee. But in addition to that, very early on, and I couldn't say exactly when, we were able to get money from the Sloan Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation. And those two additions really are what made it possible to do all sorts of, I'll say, good things.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had come to this job with an extraordinary career in which you had worn many hats, the first director of the Livermore Lab, the first head of DARPA, the ambassador to the comprehensive test ban talks. What was it about that time, your thinking, and the work of the Institute that all came together? Because the Institute did have to relate to the security environment that existed then.
Well, as a practical matter, in 1981, which is the same year they were seized with the question of the contract, I had just completed 4 years in various kinds of negotiations, the last two concerning a comprehensive test ban. And I was looking for some way in the university context to continue with what had become a major interest of mine, nuclear arms control. And so it just came out of the times. I mean, my interest in stimulation came out of my recent experience. As you say, I'd also been director of the Livermore Laboratory before that.
Let's draw Susan here at this point, and let's talk a little about that security environment. I mean, it was a bipolar world, and that's very much unlike today's world.
Indeed, it was a bipolar world, but arms control was a major element of policy at that time. We had been negotiating a nuclear test ban. We'd been negotiating the SALT agreements. Ronald Reagan had just become president, so it was clear to everybody there was going to be a big change in policy. At least at the level of rhetoric, there was going to be a big change. And so the interest was very high in getting the university involved, partly because it was a bipolar world and people were fearful about the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's different from today's world, isn't it, Susan?
Well, yes. In retrospect, the Cold War nuclear standoff looks kind of simple and stable compared to what we have today, because now there's not, you know, there are a number of different nuclear threats, and the risk of nonproliferation, which really, the whole story of nuclear nonproliferation has been quite a success story in limiting the number of countries that did go nuclear. But now it looks as if nuclear weapons are still of value to states, but we don't have some stable balance of power. And we also have non-state actors. We have the risk of nuclear terrorism from terrorist organizations as well. So there's really quite a lot for IGCC and every citizen who's concerned about this to pay attention to. Mm-hmm.
Herb, are you satisfied with the way we've navigated this transition? Now I'm talking about government policy from a bipolar world, the end of the Cold War, to this post 9/11 world, because it seems to be that the centerpiece has been the putting aside of important breakthroughs like the ABM Treaty, dismissing the Non-Proliferation Treaty, dismissing the need for talking with our adversaries.
No, I'm not at all satisfied.
Yeah.
I'm not at all satisfied. I don't have a detailed prescription about how to fix the present situation. In some areas, such as nonproliferation, it probably involves getting back on the earlier track. In other areas, it may very well have to be new. The situation is really quite different from the old one. As Susan said, the multiplicity of important actors, the possibilities of proliferation in new places. But on this point of nonproliferation, I endorse her remark that it's done. Nonproliferation policy has been quite successful. In fact, except in Southwest Asia, it still is quite successful. There's no signs of proliferation in any of the Americas, Latin America, none in Europe, and except for North Korea and Southwest Asia, there's none in Asia either. So it has been quite successful. We've even had some instances where countries have had bombs and given them up, or had bomb programs and then given them up, with the nonproliferation regime always in the background as part of the stimulus. But things are out of hand in Southeast Asia, Southwest Asia, and something has to be done different from what we're doing.
And there is a sense in which recently, the United States has really been dismissive with the current administration of all that had been accomplished and all the bargains that were implicit in the nonproliferation.
Well, right? It seems to me the current administration has been dismissive of international approaches or multilateral approaches on everything, mm-hmm. and their actions with regard to treaties like the ABM Treaty or the Non-Proliferation Treaty and so on are consistent with their general policy of go it alone, sort of a cowboy diplomacy.
Actually, the term of art now is more counter-proliferation than non-proliferation. Mm-hmm. The idea is go find the materials, track them down, and go get them, mm-hmm. Rather than using multilateral or some form of international cooperation. Although there are exceptions to that, like the Proliferation Security Initiative is an effort to work with other countries to have them find and stop shipments at sea, especially of nuclear materials.
But the idea would be that that there would be a synergy between this new framework that you're describing and the old framework. In other words, it doesn't necessarily follow that if one goes after materials and rogue states, that one would have to do away with this old architecture.
Well, I think the work that IGCC and UC faculty have been doing on nonproliferation, especially, say, Edel Solingen, who UC Irvine professor, who is the chair of our steering committee, really shows that decisions about whether or not to acquire nuclear weapons tends to be driven largely by the regional context, the regional mm-hmm. security context, and by domestic factors. What kind of domestic interest groups are dominant? And when the interest groups want to have normal relations with other countries and want to export and foreign trade is important, then those countries tend to not want to go down the nuclear road. But it's the countries that really have more isolated economies, weaker economies, and, of course, authoritarian rule that tend to go down the nuclear road.
And this helps us understand why a research unit at the University of California, such as IGCC, remains important, because although in the beginning the focus may have been on the bipolar relationship with the Soviet Union and arms control, even at the end of your term, you were beginning to look at these regional issues, and everybody knows how important they are now, especially in Southwest Asia.
Well, right at the beginning, we began to look at regional problems that had a major Cold War dimension. Almost from the very start, we had a regional study involving the Middle East. And because that conflict, like all the other conflicts, you know, took place in the Cold War context, and the Cold War context mattered in all of those. So we got into regional conflicts very early, but as part of the overwar Cold War nuclear threat context.
Mm-hmm. And this I'm hearing you both say that the skills involved and the academic disciplines involved to address these problems are really complex. They're interdisciplinary in a way that goes much beyond the founding generation, you know, in the nuclear age.
Well, right from the start, we looked everywhere in the academic world for possibilities.
Yeah.
We even got people in from the arts and the humanities, literature, and so forth. We looked for graduate students who might do a thesis that was in literature but relevant to the Cold War conflict, and we found our best candidates. We found in history, political science, international relations, but we looked everywhere, and had graduate students from all over the University of California come together once a year and talk with each other about what they were doing. And it really did draw some delightful sparks. I mean, some interesting ideas came up. Not all of them worked, I mean, but enough of them did, so that we were able to build on that early base and improve as we went along.
And it's very important to comment that often at the university, people are in their missile silos. They are focusing on how they get ahead in their discipline. But the problems that are being addressed here really have to cross disciplines and also bring young scholars in to new topics. So the threat from bioterror, although on the table in the earlier period, it has become much more important now.
That's right. And certainly getting students turned on to these important international security topics is one of our missions. And, you know, IGCC is a multi-campus institute under the Office of the President in Oakland. So we're based at UC San Diego, but we have affiliated units on every campus. And that, think about it, that's 10 campuses, and every single one of the campuses of UC has fabulous scholars. So that's a very deep bench. I mean, there's absolutely no other university-based institute that can draw from this depth of expertise on every region of the world. And, of course, we have the scientists, you know, the physicists, the nuclear engineers from Berkeley, chemists. And, you know, Herb really led the way in bringing science and social science together, because especially if you're doing something like nuclear weapons or biosecurity, you have to know the technical side as well as the international context.
Mm-hmm. And Herb and I were talking before the interview started, and one of the problems in the current situation is the extent to which our policymakers in the recent period evidenced a lack of understanding of regional politics and of national politics. when they went on what might be called their adventure.
Well, I think that's a permanent, that's a general and permanent problem. Yeah. That in the White House, and I'm pretty sure in the Kremlin, and you know, in Beijing and everywhere else, the leaders are preoccupied with getting reelected or holding onto power.
Right.
And the people whom they meet with on a daily basis, the people who, so to speak, have the leader's ear, are generally people who are good at continuing the present situation in the political sense. And so it's very rare to have somebody with the president's ear who actually understands the third world. And I'm sure that's true everywhere. It's not just in the United States. And even in the State Department and in the Defense Department, the top person, the secretary, you know, tends to focus also on those problems that the president's most concerned about, and it's only on occasion that they have time for these other issues. So that there's a permanent problem in the fact that to put it simply, people who are experts on the third world generally do not have access to the top. And that's not just this administration. It's fairly general.
Susan, you're a China specialist, one of our leading China specialists in the country. And China is moving away and has moved away from the developing category. But talk a little about how one has to begin thinking, you know, at the university about China's new role and how we have to adjust and we have to train our students to have this feel for what China is, even if they're just interested in nuclear issues or strategic issues and so on.
Well, China is now definitely a major player, and certainly there's a tendency in the United States to think of China as the new Soviet Union, the new security threat. And to maybe it's a certain nostalgia for the simplicity of the Cold War. At the same time, we see China as an economic threat, much like Japan was in the 70s and 80s. So it's no wonder you combine those two things. We've got some powerful public opinions that are driving our policy in ways that may not actually be in our national interest. So, yeah, I think there's tremendous interest among young people in studying China. Their parents are probably all saying to them, you've got to study Chinese because it's the future. But remember, people also said, you've got to study Japanese in the 1980s or you've got to study Russian. So there's a certain faddish quality here. Of course, Herb's grandchildren speak Chinese, and Herb himself, you know, is a self-taught student of Chinese. Mm-hmm. So he saw the future a long time ago.
But, you know, to throw in another idea, there's nowhere in this university or elsewhere the Indian equivalent of Chinese studies.
Yeah.
And India, you know, is very much behind China, but of growing importance. And one of the two really giant countries in the world, which seems to be on the track to assuming a greater role, and the Indians are very conscious of that, like the Chinese.
And they have nuclear weapons,
a big vacuum. Yeah. I mean, Chinese studies, Oriental studies are everywhere, mm-hmm. but the Indian studies are non-existent.
So this raises an interesting problem because to get those kind of studies started, you have to generate money, you have to have vision, and strangely enough, it's often the students who see the future in a way, and we find at Berkeley want particular kinds of studies, and they're not being offered. So both of you in your role, comment on how does the university clear that path? You see a future, but there must be resistance to putting the money down, recruiting the scholars who can teach, probably not as much finding the students who are interested.
You know, having creative faculty in the right place is the first answer.
We should mention that you were chancellor here at UC San Diego.
For a while, yes.
Yes. But go ahead. So what are the ingredients of the problem?
Well, you know, one of the things that all the chancellors do is promote interdisciplinary studies. And the faculty generally agrees that that's a good thing, except when it applies immediately to them and their careers, when it turns out to be rather difficult to do. So the general policy, which we've had for a long time, of promoting interdisciplinary studies and promoting them top-down, and bottoms-up where the right people come along, has been somewhat successful, not as successful as it should have been, but we can continue that.
Well, at IGCC, we consider our sort of being cousins with Livermore and Los Alamos in the UC system is the way you might describe it, or maybe second cousins. It's a great asset because there are folks with expertise at the laboratories, and when we develop our policy-oriented research projects, we like to work with those folks at the laboratories as well as our faculty and PhD students. Mm-hmm. And, I'll give you an example because this is all a little too abstract, maybe. Mm-hmm. There's a fellow named Neil Jock.
Yeah.
You know Neil.
Yes.
And he's UCLA PhD, one of the first PhD fellowships that IGCC ever awarded. And he taught at UCLA for a while. Then he went to work at Livermore Laboratory. Then he went to work in Washington at the National Security Council and State Department Policy Planning. His expertise is South Asia, mm-hmm. Pakistan and India, one of the great experts on politics there. He's been working very closely with us, and we had, for example, a big workshop in Washington. We have the center in D.C., mm-hmm. UC-DC.
University of California.
Yeah, which is great because that's a way where we can get the UC faculty and lab experts who are working on policy-relevant research that the policy people in Washington need to hear about, because there they listen mostly to the Beltway think tanks around Washington and the whole Northeastern corridor. But we really think that California has a distinctive perspective here, which is more long-term, more focused on Asia, Latin America, third world than just on Europe and Russia, and also more cognizant of the fact that economics are really important here. Technology, economics, the private sector. So we try to bring them in more. And I think we have a lot to contribute, and it's great that the University of California has this institute to help us do that.
It's interesting that in the case of Neil Jock, his interest in South Asia developed from its root was an interest in nonproliferation. Mm-hmm. And so he studied nonproliferation from the perspective of the Cold War and of the world and the nuclear issues generally, and through that became an expert on Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. So it was our general problem that led to that special interest.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting, and I want to underline this, that IGCC's role as a multi-campus entity means that you can draw on the talents, both faculty and students, and I know you have a very impressive fellowship program that helps students, and Neil was one of them who got one of your doctoral
degrees. And Edelson,
yeah.
And also.
Yeah, but also, because let's look at the, so here you have, we'll use the case study of Neil, here you have the whole set of issues he studied, but then on the other hand, we now discover after 9/11 the role of the communication networks of the internet as part of the equation in terrorism and so on, and so that you're able actually to build on like connections to the Berkeley Roundtable at Berkeley, to the work of Peter Cowie here at UC San Diego,
Cal IT Squared,
yeah, and you're really getting people either in their research or the students they're training, or in conferences, to talk who might not be talking.
Oh, I think it's wonderful the way Susan and IGCC have been able to move into these areas mm-hmm. that we never thought about at all. I mean, IGCC has successfully kept up with the real world and is not stuck in old issues.
Let's focus on a particular problem like nuclear terrorism. Was that on your both in your scholarship but also in your role. Was that on the agenda at all during the Cold War?
Well, scarcely. The both of the laboratories were involved in nuclear terrorism almost from the beginning of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. We're very much aware of the fact that somehow rogue individuals could get a hold of nuclear material or complete nuclear weapons and use them. And both of the laboratories have had programs dealing with that subject for many decades. I don't remember that IGCC separately got involved in that, but you know, considering us as a group that includes these laboratory efforts, they do go back before 9/11. Long before 9/11, the laboratories were involved with the question of nuclear terrorism.
And was it focused on states, that is what we call rogue states, but there was a sense that an individual or a group of individuals could put something together?
Yes, one of the laboratories each had program. They had many different programs. One facet for 50 years focused on on what would happen if some individual in the United States somehow acquired a nuclear weapon and threatened to use it. And what would you do about that? How would you handle that? What would you do? The laboratories have been involved in that issue for 50 years. And incidentally, and it's not all that well known, there have been more than 100 instances in the United States spread out over the last 40 years in which an individual has called a governor's office or a mayor's office and said, I have got a nuclear weapon, here's what I want you to do. And our laboratories have been involved in every one of those issues, as individual issues. Mm-hmm. So it's that's a very general nuclear terrorism. It's clear, but it's definitely individual, not state terrorism.
But also, after the fall of the Soviet Union, that's when the risk really grew because of the loose nuke problem. Mm-hmm. You know, you had all these nuclear facilities in the Soviet Union that were not under the best of supervision, and how to help the new Russian government and the government in the former Soviet states, you know, what to do with those nuclear materials, how to get them to exercise better control over them. And I mean, ideally, what we'd like to do is get rid of them in one way or another. I mean, one of the reasons that people now, like Kissinger and George Shultz and Bill Perry and Sam Nunn are talking about the goal of zero nuclear weapons in the world, that we should revive that as a goal, is because of the risk of nuclear terrorism. Mm-hmm. You know, not just that the states could actually end up in a nuclear confrontation, but that the continued existence of nuclear weapons inspires other states to acquire them. So you have the proliferation problem, but also you have all of this plutonium, enriched uranium in the world that can be used for terrorist weapon.
Yeah, our laboratories maintain close relationships with other nuclear laboratories in other parts of the world, particularly with the Russians. There are thousands of manned days of exchanges every year, and the bulk of those exchanges are focused on this question of controlling and monitoring nuclear materials and preventing them from falling into the wrong hands. That's a major focus of the laboratories, and it's for joint focus of the American laboratories working with the Russian laboratories. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you bring this up of moving toward the zero option, because going back to the founding of the IGCC, peace activists, were an element in Jerry Brown's wanting to push in this direction. And what would have been a policy notion that everybody in policy circles would dismiss, as the world has changed, now people are sort of thinking about that because there's a new problem, you know, new in the sense it's become much more substantial, namely nuclear terrorism.
Well, we were always in touch with the activist groups. Ruth Adams was one of the leaders in the Pugwash and peace movement women's studies otherwise, was here with us for a period of several years. Mm-hmm. So we've always had a connection with both the government, people in government areas, government offices, but also with the activist groups, with the NGOs. Mm-hmm. And all the time that I was, even when I was still a senior advisor in the government, I was active with the Council for a Livable World and the Pugwash Movement. Sometimes I felt as though I was juggling some difficult juggling act, but nevertheless managed to keep both of those things in play at the same time.
But now the activist groups are Henry Kissinger, George Shultz.
Right. Yeah.
These are hardly people, sort of ordinary grassroots citizens, yeah. Right?
But what's kind of interesting, I think, is that these ideas in the 80s, in a way you could read the founding of IGCC as, okay, if we're going to even think about this, we got to get serious about this. What can you do? You have to really get policy people together. So what you're suggesting is that the founding of the IGCC, the initial efforts, related in a way that to this activism that only became more apparent as
with the election of Ronald Reagan. You really have to credit that election as really stimulating the non-government groups, the peace activists, and so on. His rhetoric, more than his actions, really stimulated people to want to do something. And I'm sure that Jerry Brown, as an individual, you happen to be governor at the time, but as an individual, is one of those who was motivated by that political event.
Yeah. Susan, I wanted to follow up because you were also a student of comparative politics, and when we talk about bioterrorism, we talk about nuclear terrorism, it's through comparative politics that one can learn kind of or explore the motivations of these new individual actors. Talk a little about that, because it makes IGCC's work not just important because it's bringing in regional issues, but you're also bringing people in who study comparative religion and so on.
Right. Well, I mean, we don't do anything quite like anybody else. Our faculty research director for international security is an economist, Ellie Berman. He's an expert on terrorist organizations and how they work. And he has been working closely now with special forces in the Pentagon and with Department of Homeland Security to help folks understand the organization of terrorist organizations and how, whether or not, what makes them interested in or potentially capable. Are they actually capable of acts of nuclear terrorism? The good news is most of them are not. Mm-hmm. Not because they couldn't do the technology, but there are a lot of other complicated organizational challenges that they're not capable of. But there's a lot to learn about Hamas and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, obviously, and there are faculty at other places are doing fascinating research on understanding how terrorist organizations work and therefore how we can protect ourselves and how we can compete with them. And it's fascinating work.
Yeah, the reason I'm not as pessimistic about terrorism as many of my friends is that I'm aware there are many more ways to do things wrong than there are to do them right. And typically they'll find one of those. Mm-hmm. And in places like the Iraqi nuclear program and for the years in the Pakistani program, mixed competence. They had some competent people, but mixed in right in with them are people totally incompetent. And then corruption. Mm-hmm. Those are what protect us against these potential enemies.
Now we've talked about the scientific elements of the IGCC agenda, the relationship to the lab, bringing in and training young biologists and physicists about policy issues. We've talked about, you know, regional studies and area studies, but let's focus a minute on the policy side. Both of you have distinguished service in government, and you're also scholars. So what is the conundrum in bringing the best thinking together with new thinking about policy? Herb, you first, and then Susan. How do you make that happen?
Well,
because they're two different worlds with two different agendas.
Finding somehow a few people who actually can bridge the gap, and sometimes you can't. It's a question of there are plenty of people anxious to help and give advice, but as I mentioned earlier, the people at the top don't always know they need it, it's almost impossible to force it on them. You know you can organize and you can rally and so on, but unless they want your advice, it's hard to give it to them. And so that only happens occasionally, and it's hard, you know. I don't know a way to make it happen. I just know that when it does happen, it's great to take advantage of it. And I happen to be involved in several times when the people at the top actually wanted technical advice. But there have been long dry periods in the United States when the people at the top are not interested. Mm-hmm. And I've been as frustrated as anyone else. I mean, there is no answer to the question of how do you advise people who don't want advice.
Well, one of the ways that we try to do this is through Track 2 diplomacy. And what Track 2 means, it's not official. It's unofficial. It has no, it's not government to government. But what we have done in the Middle East, starting back from Herb's time, and now since 93 in Northeast Asia, is we have these Track 2 dialogues that include government officials, even military officers, at quite a senior level, but they come in a private capacity. They're not representing themselves. And then we bring in the academics as well. And the idea is to talk about how to address regional conflicts and prevent them from blowing up. And Northeast Asia one is the same six countries you hear about now in the six-party talks, mm-hmm. and it's called the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue. And people like Professor Bob Scalapino at Berkeley, you know, have been in this from 1993. And many people say it's the model for the six-party talks, which if we can actually get a decent declaration and start denuclearization in North Korea, will likely eventually become an actual permanent multilateral institution in Northeast Asia, a kind of security dialogue among the governments, which has always been my personal goal here. So these are the kinds of things you can do. And when you get the government officials off somewhere with the academics, and you know, you provide them enough vodka in Russia or Mao Tai in China, and you know, the informal environment, that's, I think, a really good setting for a lot of the transfer of new ideas to start happening.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you're saying here at the University of California and throughout the system, the relationship with the labs, the many campuses, we're uniquely positioned to think ahead and to lay the foundation for the future security problems. But on the other hand, as a matter of reality, we're not at the center of power, namely Washington. So it really becomes then important to demonstrate how important this is for the country if California is going to seize the opportunity that it has here.
Some of our, you know, some officials move from Washington to the university. I mean, I did that in 1961. But others go the other way. Glenn Seaborg, at essentially the same time, moved from being Chancellor of Berkeley to being the Atomic Energy Commission. So that It's not just advisors. There are officials also who are, and Susan in the State Department. So when I went to the Pentagon, when Glenn went to the Atomic Energy Commission, when Susan went to the State Department, we all of us brought with us backgrounds of what we had learned in the University of California. Now, nobody organized that as a plan, you know, but that's just how life worked out. Mm-hmm. And Peter Cowie, again, you know, in and out, mm-hmm. here as a scholar, there as an official.
And we do, IGCC runs a competition for students, graduate students mostly, to go be interns. Mm-hmm. But I mean at a pretty high policy level, interns in Washington. And another one of our training programs funded by the National Science Foundation, Public Policy Nuclear Threats, all of those students have had to do internships at the laboratories and in Washington. And, you know, we just get on airplanes a lot, too. And we've got this great facility, UCDC, which we're trying to make a place that Washington movers and shakers come mm-hmm. to hear some of these cutting-edge creative ideas that UC is producing.
You know, the good news is the United States does this much better and to a much greater extent mm-hmm. than any other country. We're really the envy of academics in other countries who wish they had anything, just a small fraction of the access that we have in this country. So we are way out in front in this.
And this may be a dimension of soft power that becomes important as a way of showing our leadership role when we seem to be in decline, you know, with vis-a-vis Asia with regard to economic issues. So we're a font of ideas. Now, I still am worried, and I know you worry, too, about training the next generation. I want to touch on that again. Herb, when you took over at Livermore, it was an extraordinary moment in time, a sort of talented generation just was there, present at the creation and so on. Harold Brown, you could tick off the names. What about the future? I mean, how are we going to make sure that biology students, at least some of them, aren't just doing high-tech money-making, but are also focusing on policy issues? And how do we get the social sciences to know the science that's involved?
Well, first of all, we need to recognize that was a unique time. Essentially, all of the technical leadership, all of the people who got involved in both science and government in one way or another had come out of World War II, mostly the Manhattan Project, but the radar project as well. And that you can't duplicate. I mean, that was a special case that we took, that somehow society and we took advantage of. So there is no way to, you can't do that again. What you have to do is find some substitute. And the substitute, or part of the substitute, is universities and their programs to deliberately educate people who have a broad enough interest to sort of carry on with the same kind of occupation, the same kind of dual role that came out of the Manhattan Project.
Well, it's this concern about where is the next generation of Herb Yorks and Michael Mays and people like that that really motivated us about 6 or 7 years ago to start this public policy nuclear threats training program, and we were lucky enough to get $3.5 million from the National Science Foundation to fund it. So we recruited students throughout the UC system in nuclear engineering, science specialties, chemistry, biology, physics, as well as social science, history, law. And we offered them, we were basically using these nice, generous NSF PhD fellowships to get them interested in nuclear issues. Because 6 or 7 years ago, really, there was not very much interest among students. And then we helped pay for their studies, and we started them off with the summer intensive program, which we're still running every summer, to introduce the technology, the technical and the social science policy side of nuclear issues, like how do we maintain our strategic weapons, what should our policy be with them, nonproliferation, terrorism, and specific cases of Iran or South Asia or North Korea. And then they go and they do their normal PhDs, but they are every month. We're doing video conferencing. We're meeting together once a year, and the students run this conference and come up with their own collaborative research projects. Sometimes we hold it in Washington, where the students can really speak to the policymakers about the work they're doing on interesting issues like nuclear forensics, which we could talk about. Fascinating field. Mm-hmm.
This is the idea of determining who launched a weapon after the fact?
Before the fact.
Before the fact. Oh, okay.
In other words, when you apprehend materials,
I see.
They stop them at the border. How do we know where they came from and where they've been? Mm-hmm. And the science is developing. So as I just said, you can actually figure out the path they took, not just where they originated. So how would you do this and organize international cooperation on this so that we can really prevent it from happening, discourage terrorist groups, but even more important, if we have this capability, won't this induce countries to get better control over their nuclear materials if they think that the fact that the materials came from them will be fingered at the border or somewhere else. So it's a fascinating, really frontier field.
Well, the laboratories have been engaged in this for years. They work with Interpol and the FBI and closely on all possible criminal actions. Europe is, I'll say, crawling with people. Two groups of people. One group say, I've got a bomb if you can get $1 million. And another group says, I got $1 million if you can get me a bomb. And the problem is they can't get together. You know, they can't find each other because it's nearly all fraud. It may be 100% fraud. But then they can't find each other. And, of course, there's all kinds of sting operations. It's a very active field. And the university's, through its laboratory, has been involved in that for years.
But the labs are reaching out to us because they really want the help of the UC scientists, some of whom are doing really cutting-edge work in geochemistry that can help on the technology side. But also, now there aren't that many social scientists at the labs. Mm-hmm. They're mostly scientists and engineers. And so they look to the University of California to help bring in the international relations experts and people like that to try to figure out, well, how would we structure international cooperation on something like nuclear forensics?
Since I have such enormous talent here with policy experience, academic experience, I must ask, how do each of you sort of look at this recent period and the response to 9/11, and how do you evaluate it, and how would you like to envision a future where corrections are made that draw in the university? Herb, you first.
Well, it's a sort of a little dark age, it'll end. And we'll get back on the track because there are so many people who want to get back on the track. Activists of various kinds, many of them are academics, and somehow collectively with all that intellectual energy, they'll find a way. So, I do think it's a bad time, but I'm quite confident it's a short-term problem. Many of the structures still exist, they're simply not used, so you don't even have to recreate many of them. You just have to sort of do a certain amount of clearing out some dead wood and get some new people in there. So, I don't have any advice except more of the same. The activists, academic and other, just stick with it. We'll be making a comeback out there fairly soon. I don't think you have to do anything beyond just stay active.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we are also wasting a huge amount of money in homeland defense, for mm-hmm. example, by not thinking in a very systematic way mm-hmm. about how to make ourselves safer. And there are all sorts of expensive technological fixes and monitors and widgets and all this, some of which is good business for the laboratories too. And I'm not saying that we should be naive and not do any of this, but I think we should be smarter mm-hmm. about how we invest our money. And I think some of that thinking, that kind of logical, strategic thinking, academics are quite good at. Mm-hmm. And we do have people like Bob Powell at Berkeley, who's trying to model this and understand this better, and we've had him speaking in Washington. The other thing is that, I am a believer in that our bilateral diplomacy needs to be supplemented by these multilateral efforts, mm-hmm. not just the United Nations and the Non-Proliferation Treaty globally, but also the regional ones, because for most countries in Northeast Asia or South Asia or Africa, it's really the regional context that is driving their decisions about whether or not to go nuclear, whether or not to engage in arms races with their neighbors. So I think that we have a lot of good ideas that we've been working on over the past decade or more on how to create these regional organizations. And I expect the next administration, whoever is the president, is going to move forward in that area.
Mm-hmm. And this is a theme that runs throughout the history of IGCC. I know that I interviewed you many years ago, and you talked. We were talking about the Eisenhower administration, how they came to see diplomacy in that period as very important in the arms control agenda. And obviously these second track talks are very important, because while we're not talking to North Korea, it's very good that the University of California is arranging talks and conversations, so that when the opportunity returns to move beyond the dark ages, that we're kind of ready. It sounds to me that an element in all of this that we haven't addressed, and we really maybe need to do a better job of public education on these issues. We're doing the work of coming up with new ideas, transmitting those ideas, training the next generation. But it sounds to me that we have to be part of the conversation about making the general public aware of these issues.
That's true. It's always been true. It always will be true. Okay. So, yes, indeed, we have to do that.
The agenda continues.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, IGCC's the way of doing this is through our campus programs. All those affiliated campus programs, we give them a little bit of money every year, and they bring in speakers. They have forums when there are major events in the world. And, that's how the community really gets engaged in these issues through us. Mm-hmm. We have a great website, too, that people should check.
Yeah, and so I was just going to say that your website, one needs to just Google Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, UC San Diego. And since I've interviewed both of you twice and people want to know more about your scholarship and the work that you've done, you can go and Google Conversations with History, Herb York, or Susan Shirk. I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We don't have a birthday cake. We're not going to sing happy birthday, but I think it's really been great having you both here to talk about the work of your institute and how it's continued over these many years. And I wish you another 100 years.
Thank you,
Herb, and thank you, Susan, and thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.